If you already have your Bibles open to that passage, keep them right there, because that's where we're going to spend our night tonight. And I let Caleb down by not getting that thing for him. I fell asleep on the job. So if you're not already there to Job chapter 19, please go ahead and turn there. Job chapter 19. And we're going to be looking at this chapter tonight. And I know that in my time, you know, going to church in my life, I've heard a couple of sermons and a couple of classes out of the book of Job. And primarily when I've heard these, they've dealt with the first couple of chapters of Job or the last couple of chapters of Job. And for good reason, the first couple of chapters of Job are amazing chapters. They show us how God is in control of Satan. They show us things behind the scenes that are just amazing and give you great insight into how God works and even how Satan is limited. So for good reason, you see Job chapter 1 and 2 studied. And then in the end of the book of Job, for good reason, people study that and make classes out of that because those are such interesting chapters there where God questions Job. And you get to see God's wisdom and God's power as he asks Job to tell him why these things are so and who did this and who made that and where is this stuff stored. And so the book of Job is bookended with a great beginning and a great end. But frequently, I mean, in my time, maybe you guys are different, I've not heard a lot of sermons from the middle of Job. And I think that's also probably for good reason. Because the middle of Job is Job's four friends who are debating with Job as to who God really is, what God's really like, and how does he really work in the world. And so in the middle of the book of Job, you actually have uninspired words. Now, I'm going to say that, and I'm going to say this. God inspired the book of Job, there's no doubt. But he allowed in it uninspired wisdom of man, if you will. So for good reason, perhaps, that's not studied a lot. Because what you're seeing there is Job's and his friends, their own meanderings, their own thoughts. And so you don't see a lot of sermons based off of that. But I think that there is some stuff still in those chapters that's very interesting and valuable. And tonight, I want to do Job chapter 19. As I was doing my own Bible readings, and I was just reading through the book of Job recently, and I came across that chapter, and I thought, that was a really interesting chapter. And I think it's good to read Job's friends' thoughts. I think it's good to read Job's thoughts. Because honestly, they're so human. They're so much like you and I. They have the same kinds of thoughts that you and I have, same kinds of emotions you and I have. And as they're trying to guess how God's working, it just seems so human. So I want to encourage you to do that. Read their thoughts. And they may not be right all the time. Sometimes they're flat out wrong. But they're very worthy of your time and very interesting for sure. I want to begin in Job chapter 19, verse 1. As we begin, Job is complaining. Job is complaining as we begin this chapter. Job chapter 19, verse 1. Then Job answered and said, he's answering to one of his friends. He says, how long will you torment me and break me in pieces with words? He says, these 10 times you have cast reproach upon me. Are you not ashamed to wrong me? And even if it be true that I have erred, my error remains within myself. Think for a second, if you will, about the situation Job is in. In Job chapter 1 and 2, we see that God has allowed Satan to take from him his wealth. He was a very wealthy man. His wealth is gone. We see from those chapters that Satan was allowed to kill his own his children. Satan then kills Job's kids. I think he had 10 kids in the beginning of Job, if I remember right. So his 10 children all die. And then in Job chapter 2, Job hasn't cursed God. Job hasn't done anything bad yet. And so Satan says, you know, let me torment him a little more. Let me physically reach out and make him ill. So God allows Satan to touch Job, if you will. So look at Job's life. Physically, everything he had is taken away. He has no more wealth. He has no more children. God allowed, Satan spared his wife. And perhaps he knew that she would actually become a valuable tool for him. Or she could be, because in Job chapter 2, she says what? Curse God and die. So she encourages Job to abandon God. But then we also see that so his wealth is taken, his children are taken. God allows Satan to inflict him physically. What does Job have left in his life at this point that is good? I'm going to suggest to you that Job has only one good thing going at this point in his life. And maybe I'm wrong, maybe there's more. But I'm going to suggest he has one good thing. His relationship with God. He thinks, and rightfully so, that he stands before God as a righteous man. And so he believes that he's done nothing wrong, and his friends come on the scene, and they're trying to convince him of the one thing that he has in his life that's good. They're trying to convince him that that's not good either. You have one good thing going, Job, but you know what? You're wrong. It's not even good either, because you're a sinner, Job. That's why God's punishing you. So the one good thing he has, they're trying to take that from him. So Job says, how long are you going to torment me and break me in pieces with words? You know, if you skip back to Job chapter 11, you don't have to go there, but I want to read to you from it. Job chapter 11, verse 6. One of Job's friends makes this comment. Verse 6 says, for he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. So his friend Zophar is speaking to him, and he says, you know what, God's actually being nice to you because you deserve worse than this, Job. A couple chapters later in Job chapter 15, another one of his friends speaks. In verse 20, this friend Eliphaz tells Job, the wicked man writhes in pain all of his days. And Job, he's insinuating to Job, that's why things are so bad off for you, because you're a wicked man. Let me ask you, how would you guys like to have these guys as friends? Now, before I get too hard on them, I'm going to make this point. They may be wrong in a lot of what they're saying, but when Job was in pain, when Job was alone, when Job was abandoned, these three friends went and sat with him in sackcloth and ashes for 7 days. So everything they may say in here that's not true, that's harsh and unkind, temper it with this knowledge that they sat with Job for 7 days in sackcloth and ashes in mourning with him. So while they might not be perfect friends, and the stuff they're telling Job seems heartless at times, remember that they are, in fact, in some ways, very good friends. But anyways, they think that Job is sinful, and because of this, they're telling Job, you know, you need to stop, you need to change your life. You need to stop being who you are. You need to start doing things how God wants you to do. See, his friends had an improper understanding of God. They thought if you have something bad in your life, it's because you've done something bad. And I want to just ask this question. Is this unique to Job's time? Have you guys heard of the word karma? Of course you have. Have you heard of the phrase, what goes around comes around? Of course you have. So even the thought is still true today in many people's minds that if you have something bad going on in your life, it's because you're a bad person or you've done something bad. And in fact, you can go to the book of John in chapter 9. We're not going to go there. But in John chapter 9, you may remember the story that Jesus and his disciples are entering into a city, and here is a blind man. And the disciples turned to Jesus and they said, why is this man blind? Is it because he's a sinner or his parents are a sinner? So there has been a long-standing belief in time, across time, that that things happen bad to bad people. So Job's friends are simply sharing this belief system. And Job makes the comment, he says, these 10 times you have cast reproach upon me, are you not ashamed to wrong me? So Job is saying, I'm innocent. And then he makes the comment, but even if I have done anything wrong, that's my business. He says, my error remains within myself. And if you think about it, did Job's friends have any knowledge of a sin that he had done? They had no knowledge of any sins he had done. He had done nothing wrong deserving of this kind of treatment. But Job's friends, yet, they were going to tell him that he was a sinner. They were going to come on the scene and tell him, Job, you need to change your life. You ever had people that meddled in your life? These guys are meddling in Job's life. Now, sometimes meddling comes out of a heart that loves people, right? You know, well, I love that person, so I'm doing it for their own good. And so they meddle for your own good. Other times people meddle in your life, and it's not because they love you. It's because they're trying to harm you. But here, Job's friends are meddling in his life, but they're doing it with good intention. So again, I want to always temper with what I'm saying about Job's friends with the fact that they were there for Job. Whatever else may be said of them, they were there for Job. Let's go ahead and pick up in verse 5. So we began with Job's complaint. Now we're going to see Job's suffering. And he talks of his suffering, and I think as you go through this, you're going to see that he's speaking of his suffering because he's trying to get his friends, to see, guys, you need to have compassion on me. You need to give me a break. You need to be merciful. You need to be compassionate. So he's going to go in verse 5 through 20. He's going to talk about his suffering. Verse 5, he says, if indeed you magnify yourself against me and make my disgrace an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Job begins by saying, you guys are acting like you're better than I am. You're more religious than me. You're more righteous than me. You're more holy than I am. I think he's kind of saying, that's not so. I'm a righteous man. He's again claiming to be innocent of the guilt that his friends are accusing him of. And then he makes this comment in verse 6. He says, God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Job thinks that all the things that he's done, all the things that are happening to him, are all because of God. And we actually, we're fortunate because we can go back to Job chapter 1 and 2 and we can see why these things are happening to Job. But again, from Job's mind, as Job is living this life, as Job is experiencing these circumstances, does he know why these things are happening? No. But he knows somehow that God's involved in it. And right now he thinks it's because God is against him. And we'll see that as we go through. So let's begin in verse 7. And you're going to see here, I want to list a couple of questions. And I want to pose them to you. And I want to ask if you've ever asked questions similar to these. Have you ever felt this way? Ever thought these kind of thoughts? You may say not all of them, but you may have one or two that you think, yeah, you know what? I've had those kind of thoughts. I've had those kind of emotions. So let's begin with this first question. Have you ever felt like your cries for justice have gone unanswered? Job did. Look at verse 7. Job said, behold, I cry out violence, but I am not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. This is a sad verse. Here is a righteous man crying out to God, begging for God to intervene, and he says, but I'm not answered. He's begging for God to somehow come in and get involved. He's crying out violence. He's saying, I'm being treated violently. He's crying out for help. He said, but I'm not answered. There's no justice. Have you ever felt like that? Have you ever felt like in your prayer life, in a time of trouble, that you were crying out to God, you were begging for Him to intervene? You ever felt like He just was too busy looking the other direction? You ever felt that way? Job did. Let's pick up in verse 8. He says, okay, so here's the next question I want to ask you. You ever felt like your plans, you ever felt like your goals, your objections, your goals for your life were blocked by God? Job felt that way. Verse 8 says, He has walled up. He, that's God he's talking about. God has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and He has set darkness upon my path. Job states that God has, in his mind, in his thoughts, God has blocked him in. He was trying to go, he was trying to make a journey, he was living his life, going somewhere, but God blocked it. God stopped it. You ever felt that way? It's interesting in the book of Acts to see how the Holy Spirit was guiding and moving people. But here Job feels like God has stopped him. Verse 9 says, He, God, again, God has stripped me from my glory and taken the crown from my head. Think about for a second who Job was. Job was a wealthy man, a powerful man, a righteous man, a man who helped the poor. He was a good man in so many ways. He was probably a very well respected man, very well known man. And Job says here in verse 9, you've stripped me from my glory. You've taken the crown from my head. I know that I'm certain you guys can think of situations like this. I can think of in my head of people in the church who were elders, who were deacons, who were men, women of upstanding moral fiber. You people looked up to them. And then it comes out that this person had done something sinful. And all of a sudden, how everybody had them on this pedestal, it all came crashing down. And all of a sudden, this person everybody thought was righteous and holy and godly, everybody now looks at and it's like they've been destroyed. You know, we all can look at that situation and say, yeah, because sin is a destructive force. Sin brings shame. Sin takes away your glory. But here is Job, a righteous man. He has done nothing deserving of what is happening to him. And he says, God has stripped me from my glory. You ever felt that way? The next question. You ever felt like your chance of a life of blessings on this earth are hopeless? You ever looked at your situation and thought, I don't see how it can get any better. I don't see how I can pay that bill. I don't see how I can get a job. I don't see how I can do this. I don't see how I can do that. You ever felt that way? There's just no chance for you. I don't know how I can handle the problem that I'm now facing. I don't know how I can care for this loved one. I don't know how I can do it. You ever felt that way? Job has. Look at verse 10. It says, God breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. and my hope has He, God, pulled up like a tree. Job feels like there's no hope in the life he's now living. You ever felt like God was encompassing you, surrounding you, as if you were His enemy? Job felt that way. Look at verse 11 and 12. It says, He, God, has kindled His wrath against me and counts me as an adversary, as His adversary. His troops come on together. They have cast upon their siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. We know that in old military fights, and that they would surround their enemy. They would camp around them. They'd lay siege to the city, lay siege to their dwelling place, so that they could have no food coming in, nothing going out, no people could come in. So they were isolated, completely alone. Job says that God has set up His encampment around my tent. I'm isolated. I have nothing good coming in. Every blessing that I should get is not coming. And he says, because God has, look at what he says in verse 11, He counts me as His adversary. In fact, in Job chapter 16, three chapters earlier, beginning in verse 12, Job says that He, God, set me up as His target. Job feels like that God has taken sights on him to inflict injuries, to wound him, to put him through trials and tribulations and struggles. And instead of reassuring Job, and here I'm gonna pick on the friends that I've been kind of defending a little bit, but instead of reassuring Job, instead of telling Job, you know what, God still loves you. You're not God's enemy. They actually add to it. Remember the things I read to you? It's because you're wicked, Job. It's because you deserve this, Job. So instead of being those kind of friends, they instead tear Job down. You ever felt abandoned by those who care about you? I think we all probably felt that way. Job chapter 19, beginning of verse 13. Verse 13, He has put my brothers, God has put my brothers far from me, and those who knew me are wholly estranged from me. You ever felt that way? Now, I will say this. Is he talking about biological brothers there? Probably not, because we're going to see that he seems to refer to them in a moment. He's probably talking about people here that he just was friends with. He has put my brothers far from me, and those who knew me are wholly estranged. Hold your finger in Job and turn over to Proverbs chapter 19. Proverbs chapter 19. Don and I were reading this the other morning, and I was already kind of wanting to do a sermon on Job chapter 19, wasn't sure how I was going to do it. And then I read these two verses, or a couple of verses here, and it reminded me of what Job just said, that his friends are abandoning him. Remember, he was a man of wealth and of power, and now all of a sudden he has no wealth, he has no power. He's in most people's minds a nobody at this point. Notice what happens to friends. According to Solomon in Proverbs 19, notice what happens to a wealthy man when his wealth is gone. Verse 4. Wealth brings many new friends, but a poor man is deserted by his friend. Skip down to verse 6. Many seek the favor of a generous man, and everyone is a friend to a man who gives gifts. All a poor man's brothers hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? Proverbs, Solomon here, strikes at what's happening in Job's life. He's been isolated from all those people who love him, who should have loved him, who should have been there for him. Go back to Job chapter 19. Job chapter 19. So verse 13 said, He has put my brothers far from me, and those who knew me are wholly estranged from me. Verse 14. My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. We know his relatives failed him. We know that his wife tells him to curse God and die. And we're going to see more about her in just a second, but Job says, they failed me. My close friends, they've forgotten me. Verse 15, the guests in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger. I have become a foreigner in their eyes. So he's talking about people who were in his house, who were subservient to him, who were below him, because they worked for him. He says, they treat me as a stranger. Verse 16, I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. I must plead with him with my mouth for mercy. Even his own servants, they think they're above him. They think maybe they have the same kind of a mentality that his friends do. Maybe they think that he is suffering because he deserves it. He must have sinned somehow and I didn't know it. So I'm not going to give him any compassion. I'm not going to give him any mercy. I'm not going to give him a break. Have you ever felt like that? You ever felt like somebody doesn't know the situation, but they're not going to give you compassion? Not going to give you a break? Not going to give you any chance? Yet Solomon, we also know that he says, until it's been investigated, we don't know. Until when a neighbor comes and presents his case, it sounds like a good thing until the other one comes and presents his case. You ever felt like you don't get to present your case? Yet they're angry with you, they're unhappy with you? Job hasn't got to present his case. He's in the midst of presenting it, but people are still treating him wrong. Verse 17. My breath is strange to my wife. Even his own wife doesn't know him anymore. Even his own wife wants nothing to do with him. She doesn't even recognize my breath anymore. And he continues, and I am a stench to the children of my own mother. Even my own siblings want nothing to do with me. You ever felt that way? Verse 18. You're going to see that he's a joke. He's mocked by the children of the city. Verse 18. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. Verse 19. All my intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I loved have turned against me. You ever felt like those who should have your back, those who should be there to support you, those who should be there to give you strength, you ever felt like they weren't there? Job felt that way. Then in verse 20, he makes this comment. He says, my bones stick to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Job talks about what he's going through, being abandoned by his friends. He talks about what he's going through as he perceives that he is God's enemy. He talks about what he's been going through physically. He says, my bone is sticking to my skin and to my flesh. You know, I think that we all understand that if you're physically sick, it can affect you spiritually if you allow it. But Job doesn't allow it to do so. But nevertheless, he points out that he feels like he's being physically consumed. So we looked at Job's suffering. Now we're going to look at Job's request. Verse 21 and verse 22. He says, he's talking to his friends here, his three friends he's been debating with, and he says, have mercy on me. And he says it again, have mercy on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? What a great lesson this is on what it is to be a friend. You know, I've kind of talked about their good qualities. That whatever else be said, when you have friends that are going to come and sit with you for 7 days in sackcloth and ashes, whatever else they do, those are good friends. But these friends, even though they're good friends, they're giving Job bad guidance. They're giving Job bad counsel. Instead of picking up a friend who's fallen down, instead of picking up a friend who's hurting, they're kicking him while he's down. They're kicking him while he's down. That's why he began in Job chapter 19, verse 1, with how long will you torment me? How long will you torment me? You know, when you look at the life of Christ, and as Christ dealt with people who were down and out in their life, you don't see Christ acting like Job's friends. When you look at familiar stories, when you look at the woman who was brought to him in adultery in John chapter 8, what does Jesus do first? Does he first say to her, you rotten sinner, get out of here. How dare you? You know, he doesn't say, toss the stones on her. He doesn't do that. What is the very first thing Christ does? What is the very first thing you see him do? Well, he writes on the ground, but we don't know what he writes. So let's talk about what we actually know he does. What is the first thing he does? He says, if you don't have any sin, you cast the first stone. And he gives everybody a few minutes, and they all start clearing out. Then he turns to the woman, and he says, where are your accusers? She says, I don't have them. They're all gone. And what does he do? Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. So what do we see Christ doing? We see him, first of all, sheltering somebody, protecting somebody, loving somebody. Then you certainly, and rightfully so, you see him tell this person, stop sinning. But first thing Christ does is not to kick them when they're down. It's to protect them when they're down. Another story we're familiar with. Peter sinking in the water, Matthew chapter 14. Peter gets out of the boat, walks on the water to Christ, and he starts to sink. What is the first thing Christ does? He doesn't chastise Peter because his faith is weak. He doesn't say, Peter, start swimming. The first thing Jesus does, Mark, I think, uses the word immediately stretches out his hand and grabs Peter. What's the first thing Christ does? He picks up his friend that is sinking. Then he tells Peter, after he's picked him up, where was your faith? Job's friends needed to learn this lesson, that when a friend is down and out, the first thing you do is not kick them. First thing you do is you pick them up. You reassure them. You have mercy on them. You have compassion on them. There will come a time for you to offer them advice and counsel, and that will be, and that's, there's a time and place for that. It's not immediately when they're heartbroken and hurting. Job's friends needed to learn this lesson. So we see Job make this request, have mercy on me. Verse 23, now we're going to see Job's request, now we're going to see Job's wish. Job's wish. Verse 23, oh that my words were written, oh that they were inscribed in a book, oh that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. Look at verse 23, oh that my words were written, oh that they were inscribed in a book. What book are we reading from right now? The book of Job. Job gets his request granted. Why does Job want it written down? Why does Job want these things that are happening to him put in book form? Because Job wants people who are going to live sometime in the future, he wants us to look at his life and say, you know what? He was a righteous man. Job wants to be vindicated. So he says, I wish that it could be written down so that people can look at this later and realize that I wasn't sinful. I wasn't an evil person. I wasn't a bad person. So Job wished that somebody would write this down, and that's exactly what we are looking at tonight. His wish came true because God granted it. Verse 25, we're going to now see Job's faith. And this is really the heart of the lesson. He says, for I know that my Redeemer lives, and he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold him, and not another. My heart faints within me. Albert Barnes commented on the word Redeemer, and he says, it is one who took up the cause of a friend. One who took up the cause of a friend. Job then says, I know. Notice that he is certain. He says, I know my Redeemer. And this is a personal thing for Job. I know that I have a friend who is going to take up my cause. That's what Job is saying here. I know my Redeemer lives. That's some great faith, isn't it? Job may have seemed alone. He may have felt alone. He may have felt like God had forsaken him. His friends had forsaken him. But his belief in God, his faith in God, in spite of this, was unyielding. He was certain God would vindicate him. He was certain that his friend would come and make things right. And so he could say with confidence that I know my Redeemer lives. Things may have seemed hopeless, but he had great faith. I want to read to you another quote from Albert Barnes. Albert Barnes wrote, he may be afflicted with disease or the loss of property, or be forsaken by his friends, or persecuted by his foes. Now listen again. He may be afflicted, forsaken, persecuted. Here he says, but if he can look up to heaven and say, I know that my Redeemer lives, he will have peace. Let me ask you, have you ever felt like you were afflicted, that you've suffered a loss, that you've been forsaken by friends, that you've been persecuted? You ever felt this way? You know, when we're going through trials, when we're going through struggles, when we're going through hardships, and we all are, we're all going to go through them. If we can have the faith that Job has that says, I can still look up to heaven and I can know that I have a friend who's going to be there for me, that I know my Redeemer lives. Albert Barnes says, if I can look up to heaven and say that, says he will have peace. You want to have peace while you're suffering? You want to have peace when you're struggling and having hardships? Have the kind of faith Job did. That in spite of all these things, and again, he didn't understand them. He had no way of knowing that this was all God using Satan to make Job a better person, really. To give us a great lesson. But he was confident that God would vindicate him. Albert Barnes continued. He said, however long he, Job, was to suffer, he had the utmost confidence that God would vindicate him. Did you notice the first words Albert Barnes used? However long. How many times have we been through hardships and struggles in our life and we just didn't know when they were going to end? I mean, you don't know when they're going to end. Are things going to get better? Are they going to get worse? Is something going to stop my suffering? Is something going to heal my broken heart? You don't know when it's going to end. Albert Barnes said however long he was going to suffer, he had the utmost confidence God was going to vindicate him. You know, we never know when our trials are going to end. We never know when our struggles are going to cease. We look at the book of Revelation, you see the Christians in the first century crying out for God to intervene, crying out for God to get involved, to stop the persecution. But you know what? Most of them died without ever seeing any break. We don't know when that break's going to come in our sufferings, in our hardships, in our struggles, when life seems hopeless, when you don't know how you're going to get through. We don't know when it's going to come. But do we have the faith in God that it will come? There was a quote that my Uncle Don used to always say, and I like this quote, and I'm going to say it twice because I think it's powerful, and I want you to be able to digest it a bit. And again, it's going with the thought of however long we suffer. It says, "On the plains of hesitation lie the bleached bones of millions of people who on the verge of victory sat down." One more time. "On the plains of hesitation lie the bleached bones of millions of people who on the verge of victory sat down." You never know when you're about to win. You never know when your suffering's about to stop, when God's about to use you to do something great. You never know. The point of that quote is don't sit down. Don't quit. Keep on struggling. The theme of the book of Revelation is overcome it. Keep pushing. Job didn't know how long things are going to go, but he had great faith. He knew he was abandoned by his friends. He knew his family was destroyed. His wife had forsaken him. Material things were gone, physically wasting away, and yet he is certain God is going to redeem him. And then he makes the comment. He says, "And I shall see God for myself." He says, "My eyes shall behold him and not another." He says, "I'm going to personally know that I'm vindicated." Did Job get to live to see that? Did God speak to him out of a whirlwind? Did God tell Job, "Go tell your friends they need to repent"? Isn't that kind of ironic? Job was vindicated by God. Let's look at the last two verses and then the lesson will be yours. Verse 28 and verse 29. So we end it with Job warning his friends. He's telling them, the guys, if you don't stop doing what you're doing, you're going to be judged. He says, "If you say how we will pursue him and the root of the matter is found in him," he says, "be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment." Isn't it interesting that Job's concern is even for his friends? He's going through this hardship, he's going through these struggles, but Job is still worried about his friends. "Guys, you better stop because what you're doing is wrong." But the point of tonight's lesson really is this. We have a Redeemer that lives. We have someone who is ready to help us through our hardships, ready to be there for us. We may not always see Him, we may not always sense He's there, but we should know He's there. We should be confident of that. If you're here tonight and you're going through hardships, if you're struggling, if life seems hopeless, we want to help in any way we can. Please come as we sing a song that's been selected.